long. And we're going to cover some basic vocabulary and talk a little bit about the theories of magic and the sources of magic in history. First of all, here's the most important question, of course. What is magic? I'm going to ask a few other questions. Is it real? Who does it? And who believes in it? Okay, these are some very important questions, and in some ways, history doesn't really answer these questions. Do we know what magic is? Do we know if magic is real? All we can really study is what people say. All we can study is the historical evidence. So we can look at the texts, we can look at the behavior of people, but do we know if magic is real? Maybe there are other ways to find out. Maybe science can determine if magic is real. But history is not really in the business of deciding if magic is real. So when we do the history of magic, there's some things that we can't study. If I were to talk to a magician, if I asked him, "Do you believe magic is real?" And he said, "Yes." This is historical evidence, but what is it evidence for? Is it evidence that answers the question, is it real? Not really. But it does answer the question, who believes in it, right? This guy, this magician, believes in magic. So we'll talk a little bit about theories of magic, but in history, we don't make theories of magic that try to prove if magic is real or prove that magic is not real. And when you study the history of theories of magic, you find that a lot of the time people define magic in ways that try to answer this question. So some theories of magic don't really work for historical study. I'll give you an example from Christianity. Here is a list of four philosophers who had opinions about magic during the time that we're going to cover. Saint Augustine, who was a very famous Christian philosopher, lived in the 5th century AD. Magic is demonic activity, right? Magic is the activity of evil spirits, evil creatures. Magic is anti-Christian. Magic is anti-religion. Many of the people who study the history of magic make theories that sort of match this idea from Augustine, that magic is demonic, that magic is anti-religion. Now, other theories say that magic is sort of like the beginning of religion, that magic is proto-religion. So we can write these down. Is magic anti-religion? Is it proto-religion? What about the relationship of magic to science? Many people who did magic believe that they were doing a scientific sort of an activity, that the world has natural forces. Let me give you an example. The ancient philosopher Plotinus believed that magic was a natural force of the universe. Magic works by natural, sympathetic forces. He also believed that if you are a philosopher and you know how to think like a philosopher, magic can't hurt you because you think on a higher level. But the point is that magic was a part of nature. So the magician is really a scientist. Other people who have made theories about magic have said, well, magic obviously doesn't work, right? We're modern people and we know that you can't I can't squish your head by moving my fingers like that, right? We know that magic doesn't work, right? We have science, we have physics and chemistry. We don't need magic. Okay, so some people think that magic is anti-science. Sometimes they draw a triangle where you've got magic, you've got science, you've got religion, and there's sort of an oppositional relationship between all these things. The problem with these theories is that when we look at the evidence, when we look at the historical evidence about magic, we discover that there are scientific elements and religious elements to magic. A great example of this is in the Greek magical papyrus, or the Greek magical papyri, that's the plural form of papyrus. Do you guys know what a papyrus is? A papyrus is a paper, but it's like the old ancient Egyptian type of paper. And in these Greek magical papyri, the magician does what seems like a religious ritual to get in touch with a god or a spirit and to have his magical activity happen. He does religious rituals to make the magic happen. So is magic the same as religion? Is it the opposite of religion? Or should we even ask a question like that? Some historians say we need to forget this idea if magic and religion are the same or if magic and religion are opposites. And we need to come up with new ways of studying it. Okay, so magic is a big problem. Magic is a very controversial idea. We don't really know how to define it. So how do people study it? Well, I'm going to talk about a couple of disciplinary approaches, different disciplines that people use to study magic. I'm going to talk a little bit about anthropology. Do you guys know what anthropology is? What does it study?
Human.
The human, good, yeah. Anthropology is the study of humans. And especially, anthropology loves to study humans before civilization. Right? Humans who live in what we call primitive societies. Societies that don't have civilization, right? Ancient tribes, indigenous tribes. So before America, who lived here in America? Did the English live here in America? No. Before people came to America from Europe, there were the Indians, right? The Native Americans. The Native Americans would be an example of a primitive people before civilization. They had tribes, they had groups, they had politics, but they didn't build cities, right? So we talk about prehistoric or primitive magic, so that's what anthropology studies. And there are still primitive people who exist in the world, right? If you go to the Trobriand Islands, right? If you go to some of these places where there's no civilization and tribes have never met modern man, anthropologists go to these places and they study the people and they learn about their beliefs. Sometimes they learn about the religions and they study these religions. And one of the big questions that we have in anthropology is this. Is magic a universal category? Maybe magic is the beginning of religion, and before religion you have magic, right? Do you find magic everywhere? Do all people all around the world have magical beliefs or believe in spirits? One term that anthropologists have created is animism, the belief that primitive religion is a all around the world, universal, all people believe in spirits, right? All people believe that there are magical forces in the cosmos. So some anthropologists have advanced theories that the beginnings of religion is a sort of a magical belief. Another very important term is shaman or shamanism. Now, the shaman is a type of magical or religious functionary in Russia, but the term shamanism has been used to apply to magic all around the world, or religion all around the world in a primitive context. What do shamans do? They bang on drums, they take drugs, they go in the sweat lodge and sweat, right? They breathe in a bunch of smoke. And they don't sleep for 3 days, right? They do all kinds of things to change their consciousness, and they put their body through a lot of torture. What about in religious studies? In religious studies, we often study magic in relation to these questions about religion, right? Is magic the opposite of religion? Is it anti-religion? Or are there religious elements to magic? And when we get to the Renaissance, we're going to learn about a couple of philosophers, Ficino and Pico della Mirandola, who had a different interpretation of magic, and they believed that magic was religious, and not just religious, but it was good. Right? It was kind of a good thing that you could do. Although they had important limits on how much magic was going to be allowed. Both Ficino and Pico argued that magic was only natural. It's not spiritual, right? Magic is only about the natural world, but it teaches us things that can give us religious insight. Let's talk a little bit about the ancient sources of magic that we study. Oh, I'm sorry. We need to talk a little bit about sociology. This is another interesting example. Sociology is the study of society, right? And the study of the ways that people communicate, the ways that people come together. Sociologists like to ask, why do people believe in magic, right? And even today, many people believe in magic. It's a big problem because the modern world is not supposed to believe in magic, right? The modern world is supposed to be what we call disenchanted. And there's a famous thesis by the most important sociologist, his name was Weber, about how the modern world is a disenchanted world. One of the big problems for sociologists who believe in the disenchantment thesis, the idea that the modern world is disenchanted, is why do so many modern people still believe in magic? Very interesting question. But we're not going to be talking about modern people. That's going to be in a future lecture when I'm going to ask, is the modern world really disenchanted, and did magic really decline? Okay, ancient sources. I have to pick it up because we're running out of time, I can see. So, in the ancient world, now when I talk about the ancient world, I'm talking about the beginnings of civilization. Can you think of the names of a few ancient civilizations?
Egypt.
The Mayans, is that ancient?
Oh, the Mayans, that's a good example of an ancient society. The Babylonians, the ancient Romans, the ancient Greeks. We find a lot of evidence for magic in all of the ancient civilizations. Going back to this question, right, is magic a universal category? Well, we do find evidence for what people are calling magic in many different ancient societies. But the problem is many of our sources are non-textual. It's very difficult to study ancient magic when you only have the amulet, right, you know, that somebody wears around their neck and it has a special symbol. Right, and if you say the magic word, this will open the door to get you into the... Oh, wait, that's actually just science. but, you know, an amulet is something that people would wear for protection from spirits, right? Or they would put it on the wall, things like that. We also find textual sources in ancient magic. They're often difficult to read. Sometimes they weren't written by people who were philosophers, but they were just written by somebody who didn't really know how to read very well. So we find very bad language in some of these. Sometimes it was learners, right, who were writing. What were the purposes of magic in the ancient world? Let's talk a little bit about that. So one of the ways that we can define magic is in terms of the function. What does it do, right? Why do people believe it? Why do people want to do magic? And it ties into a lot of kind of basic human desires. People think you can use magic to do harm, to hurt people, at a distance, right? If I stick a pin into this doll, it's going to hurt the person who the doll represents. This is the theory of contagion, by the way. To know the future, we call it divination. You ever use tarot cards or spin the wheel of fortune? There's many different ways that people use divination when they want to learn the future. This is a magical practice. Protection. If you can do harm by magic, maybe you need protection. And we talked about this idea from Plotinus, right? He's still worried about magic, and he says the philosopher is protected from magic. So you don't have to do magic. If you do philosophy, you can be protected too. Another very important thing is control. Right, I'm in love with a beautiful girl, but I'm ugly, I'm fat, and I'm bald, right? Can I make her love me with a love spell? We find some interesting love spells in the ancient world. After the ancient world, we come to medieval sources. Medieval sources are getting a little bit easier to study, but we have other problems. Now, in the medieval world, we have Christian civilization, Islamic civilization, Jewish civilization. Those are going to be three major sources of magic. And an interesting thing happens. The Jewish, Christian, and Islamic sources are all sort of coming together. The people are communicating with each other. They're reading different texts. And the ideas from Islamic and Jewish magic come into Christian magic. One of the most important medieval sources are what we call grimoires. A grimoire, that's a word that means a grammar, actually. It's like the grammar of magic. It's a book that contains the language of magic or the grammar, how to do it. Grimoires, the problem with grimoires is that they're instructions only. They don't explain the theory, the philosophy. They don't explain how they think it works or why they think it works. They just explain what you're supposed to do. And one of the interesting things about the grimoires, once again in terms of this question about religion, is that the grimoires are filled with religious instructions. You're supposed to pray, right, for 3 hours. And often you have to pray a lot. You have to do an excessive amount of prayers, or you have to write down a religious word 100 times. Do things like that. So once again, religion is still a problem if you want to believe that magic is the opposite of religion. We also find a lot of information for the study of magic in law in the Middle Ages. For example, in the hunt for witches. You know, the witch, right, on Halloween, she's got the ward on her nose. Right, I'm going to get you, my pretty. The evil witch, right, is this character. People believed that witches were men and women who became possessed by demons or possessed by the devil, and that they were sort of spreading a kind of evil, anti-religious magic. And a lot of people were actually executed by the state for being witches, or at least people thought that they were witches. And
it's all women, too.
Yeah, a lot of women. Well, actually, there's a lot of men. It's kind of...
Men, witches,
and women. The idea that it was all women is exaggerated. It depends on the area.
Okay.
Right? And even during the Salem witch trials, there were men who were executed. Like the guy who was crushed under a bunch of rocks as part of his punishment. It's interesting, though. The stereotype is that the witch is feminine, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this idea that, oh, people believe that women were more susceptible to demonic influence. They were more vulnerable. It was easier to make a woman into a witch. But yeah, we had male witches, and a lot of men were burned at the stake or beheaded or executed in all these horrible ways. But one of the reasons that witchcraft became very important in law during the Middle Ages is some people said, hey, you know, how do you know if this person's a witch? Right? How can we find out? How can we be sure? We need to use science. Right? And so a lot of the developments that happened in law happened as a result of people trying to figure out the right way to take care of a witch. It's sort of like terrorism, right? Terrorism is so scary, it's so dangerous. We need special laws to deal with terrorism, right? They needed special laws to deal with the witches in the Middle Ages. We also find a lot of interesting sources in philosophy. If you're walking across campus, you see Albertus Magnus building, right? He was a famous philosopher who was interested in magic. He believed that magic was just science. He was interested in alchemy, and as a result, he became very famous for promoting these ideas. And so there are actually magical texts that people say were written by Albertus Magnus that are floating around. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about the changes that happened in magic during the Renaissance, lead into our next lecture, which will be about Renaissance magic. Now, the Renaissance is a period when the ideas from Islamic civilization were rediscovered. The ideas, especially of ancient Greek civilization, philosophy, and science that had been lost to Europe, came back to Europe, and it all came from the Arabic philosophers and scientists who had kept this information alive. And in the Renaissance, it's called a renaissance. It means like a rebirth or a rediscovery of all this ancient learning. Well, a lot of this ancient learning had a lot of magical ideas kind of tied up in it. And so philosophers like this guy Ficino and his student Pico della Mirandola, they were studying the ancient philosopher Plato, and they were studying magic, sort of together. And they came to believe some interesting things. So here's an example of what Ficino believed. Ficino wrote a book called De Vita Coelitis Comparandi, which means comparing your life to the sky, right, to the heavens. He believed that magic can heal people, especially students. Why are students in danger? Well, students are always studying, right? They get fat, right? And they get melancholy, they get depressed. So what they need to do is go outside and soak up the sun. And they need to be in love, and they need to listen to music. They need to actually associate with things that are like the sun, things that are like the planet Jupiter, and things that are like the planet Venus that are healthy and can counteract the planet Saturn, which makes you depressed and feel black. He thinks that people can arrange their lives in harmony with the heavens. So what we learn from the stars, and there's just a whole lot of complicated information about what they believed was connected to the star. The sunflower is connected to the sun, right? And also gold is connected to the sun, and the heart is connected to the sun. So if your heart has a problem, you should eat some gold, right? Because gold is a sun drug, right? And it's going to cure your heart, right? It turns out there's other reasons why eating gold might help you with a heart condition, but the ancient people and the medieval people believed that this sort of thing worked that way. So in the Renaissance, we have a phenomenon known as learned magic. People think that magic is a very high form of learning, a very high form of science. Pico della Mirandola said magic is the highest part of natural philosophy, the highest science. And Pico also thought that magic could help you to prove Christianity. He said, nothing proves the divinity of Jesus more than magic and the Kabbalah. And he got in trouble with the Pope for saying that, of course. But he was giving voice to this new role of magic in the Renaissance. In the Renaissance, magic became a new type of religious problem. A lot of philosophers, a lot of learned people were interested in magic. A lot of them were saying that, well, you know, magic is really just natural philosophy. They're saying that St. Augustine was wrong, right? Augustine thought magic is what demons do or what Satan does. But these guys, Ficino and Pico, they believed that magic was something useful. They believed that if you could make gold using alchemy, well, that's a good thing. That can help. If you can make weapons using magic, that can help the state, right? If you could make weapons that could destroy a castle wall, we could use that to invade. So in our next lecture, we're going to hear about changes that are happening to the history of magic in the Renaissance. Thank you so much for coming. Does anybody have a question before we go?
You have a question, Ted. I came in late, so I don't know what you came in, what you talked about in the beginning. And this could be just my,